Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
The Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Getting a lesson from the Shadow Chancellor on how to balance the books is like getting a lesson from Dracula on how to look after a blood bank.
Ed Balls.
A steady as she goes budget. What kind of ship does he think he's on, the Titanic? Memory Celeste.
Welcome to EMQs from Political Currency
with Ed Balls and George Osborne.
Hello and welcome to EMQs. This is our weekly take as ex-ministers at answering your questions, and you keep sending in so many fabulous questions and responding to our requests, because last week we were asked a question about what the worst or most sort of damaging or most impactful photograph we could think of recently in British politics. And Ed, you suggested as a good example, and maybe not the most impactful, but a good example is Ed Miliband eating a bacon sandwich. And I talked about that photo of Boris Johnson in the Downing Street garden taken from Rishi Sunak's window. But we've had some other ideas sent in.
We should say that you won. The Boris in the garden photo won the Instagram poll. Oh. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to accept. I don't want to just accept on behalf of myself. I should thank all those involved, like Boris Johnson, for example.
And Dominic Cummings.
Dominic Cummings. Yeah. Half the people in the photo are now in the House of Lords. Now,
that's okay then.
Yes.
The nation's secure.
The nation's moved on, actually.
But we also had some other good examples. David Miliband and the banana.
Oh, come on. You must have loved that. There must have been a massive smile on your face when that appeared on the front. This, for those who don't remember, it was a Labour Party conference. There was a lot of speculation that Gordon Brown as Prime Minister might be challenged by David Miliband for the top job. And he was trying to say, look, of course, I'm not going to challenge the Prime Minister. And he turned up in front of all the cameras at the conference holding a banana, which is, I think he was trying to say, look, I'm just having a snack. I'm, you know, not plotting. But it made him look like a bit of a banana, didn't it?
It did.
You loved it. Come on.
No, I felt it was diverting from the underlying message and purpose of the government.
There's a massive Cheshire grin on the face of Edward Balls at the moment, for those who can't
I didn't think
him.
It was a great photo. Jacob Rees-Mogg asleep on the House of Commons benches.
Yes, that was him horizontal, wasn't it? He was sort of lying there like a kind of 19th century painting of the House of Commons.
And then there's Callaghan in the sea at Guadeloupe in 1979. I've got to say, I don't remember that one.
Ah, I did. This is Crisis What Crisis, isn't it? I think.
Could be.
Isn't this him during the winter of discontent? He's actually at some conference, maybe a Commonwealth Leaders Conference or something like that. And, you know, he goes for a dip and it's all like he's in the sea while the, you know, country's struggling. There was also, of course, this was not a photograph. This was I'm not sure we're allowed
to. Are you going
to
say Neil Kinnock?
Neil Kinnock. He fell into the sea with his wife.
Glenys.
Who
pulled him out.
Yes. This was, he'd just been elected Labour leader. There was already a question at that point. Of course, he was the young kind of unknown backbencher who was being chosen to lead the Labour Party and get them out of the mess that Michael Foot had put them in. And he
made him look about 3.5.
He went to celebrate on the beach. I don't know where it was, Blackpool, Bournemouth, somewhere like that.
Oh, it was Brighton.
Brighton.
Anyway, we should get on with it because we ran out of time. Our first question is from David.
Hi, Ed and George. It's Dave here from Rugby. I've just been walking the dog listening to your wonderful podcast. My question is, if somebody is 27 points ahead in the polls, is that miles ahead? Is it 27 out of 1,000? Is it 27 out of 50? How's it worked out?
Well, David, I sometimes listen to this podcast walking my dog as well. Me and Albie listen to the podcast as I take her out in the evening.
What does he think of it? She think of it? He or she? Is Albie a man or a woman?
Well, it's a boy's name, but it's a girl.
Okay.
It's actually named after the town of Albie in southwest France, she is.
What does she think of your contributions?
Woof, woof. She thinks they are excellent. And David, your question is quite straightforward to answer. When you say 27 points behind the polls, we mean 27%. It's essentially you do an opinion poll, how many people say they're going to vote Conservative, how many people say they're going to vote Labour, and what's the gap between them? And at least some polls recently have had numbers like 27.
I don't want to be pedantic, but it's actually 27 percentage points.
27%.
So if it was 50 versus 25, it would be a 25 percentage point lead, but it wouldn't be a 25% lead. Because actually that would be 25% lead would be a quarter of 25. So it'd be 32 and a half.
Okay, but in the shorthand of British politics, people do say a 25% lead.
Yeah, but they mean percentage points.
I do remember once in William Hague's office where I was working for him. He was leader of the opposition. And someone came in and said, it's terrible. Labour's got a 40% lead. And William Hague says, 14%. Oh my God, that's terrible. And they went, no mistake, it's a 40% lead. So, you know, if you're sitting there listening to this as a Tory MP and think, oh, things can't get worse, I'm afraid I've been there and they can.
But the answer to David's question is that there's times when I think Blair and Brown were miles ahead, 95 to 97, but they never believed these big leads. And then Ed Miliband, in the run-up to 2015, was ahead in the polls, not 27 points, but definitely into double figures, and it turned out to be a shimmerer. But I think the thing you always have to watch out for, David, is the don't knows, because they are often not counted. And if you have a lot of people who don't know and they get excluded, so it can look like it's close, but if the don't knows are being excluded and then the don't knows all suddenly decide to vote for one side or the other, that can suddenly transform. So you can have a big poll lead because the don't knows say they're staying at home and then they all decide to come out and vote for the other side and suddenly your lead disappears. So always look out for the don't knows.
I should say, you know, so if you want to make the case for why the Tories might win the next election, at the moment, on the most recent poll, there are 24% of people who say they don't know, which is very high at this point. And 80% of those 24% did vote Conservative at the last election, i.e. their previous vote was Conservative. So what Tory central office, what Isaac Levido, the campaign manager for the Conservatives, is going around telling the Tory MPs is hold your nerve. There's a large number of undecideds, a large number of don't knows, still a quarter of the electorate. And when they were asked last time, they voted Conservative. So they are more likely to vote Conservative than Labour this time, is the argument. But that's the message that the Tory MPs are receiving at the moment.
On the other hand, the latest YouGov poll, Labour lead at 25%. Listen to this. Conservatives, 19. Reform, 15.
I mean, we're reaching a crossover
could
point.
You get to, I mean, that would be amazing.
That would, well, we were talking on our podcast, weren't we, last week about political spirals when things are going wrong for you. And I can tell you that if Reform starts polling higher than the Tories, that will be a significant downward shift in the spiral. Anyway, we should move on to our next question from Kirsty.
Hi, George and Ed. I have a question about the new non-dom situation. Everyone keeps saying that Jeremy Hunt has made it very difficult for Labour by changing that and saying, oh, that money's now been spent on the NI cut. Why can't Labour just come in and say, oh, we're not doing that. We're going to use that non-dom money elsewhere. Why has it gone? I don't understand. Where has it gone? Thank you.
Well, the answer, Kirsty, is it's not gone. It's not been spent. The money's not even come in yet because they've not even enacted the non-dom changes. But what the government has done in the budget has said when that money comes in the future, we are going to allocate it towards a cut in national insurance. And Labour has chosen to say we will match, we will continue with the cut in national insurance. Labour could have said, no, we're not going to have the cut in national insurance. We will instead in the future use the non-dom money for something else. But then they would be open to the charge that Labour will put up national insurance after the election. They don't want to be vulnerable to that. So it's all to do with what is scored for future years in the government's, the Treasury's red book, it's called, in the fiscal tables. And that's the reason.
It sounded like Kirsty was actually walking her dog when she asked that question. So maybe we're big among the dog walkers of Britain. But no, I don't really have anything to add. I mean, there was a choice there. You might not have noticed it, but Labour chose to accept the Conservatives' cut in national insurance. And of course, you know, in government, Labour made a big decision when Ed was involved to increase national insurance. So you could make a counter argument. They could have said, no, we're going to keep national insurance where it is and use this money on reducing waiting lists in the health service, for example. So they're at the moment Labour sticking very closely to the Tory spending and tax bans because they don't want to end up giving more chinks of light. And also there's quite a lot of talk that they don't want to kind of explain now where the missing money for the things they were going to spend the non-dom money on, like some improvements in the NHS and dentistry and breakfast clubs and schools, because they think if they set out another tax plan, it will be swiped by the Tories before the election.
They've been helped, though, by Jeremy Hunt dangling this idea of abolishing national insurance. It allows Labour to say that would cost £45 billion. That's an unfunded commitment. Where's that going to come from? That won't last till election day, but it buys them a little bit of political space to do their thinking, but they're going to have to answer that question well before the election.
I should say, by the way, we've talked on this podcast before about, are the Tories going to have another fiscal event, a kind of budget-like event before the election? And I had definitely heard strongly that they were not going to, but the speculation has come back, perhaps because they thought the budget was actually not a bad moment for them, and they may not have capitalised on it with all the problems that Sunak's facing, but perhaps they could capitalise on one again in September and then have that October or November election.
A September fiscal event would look quite disorderly.
I'm still going anyway for a mid-November general election, but we will see. Now, on to much more important things. We've got a question from Jimmy.
Jimmy says, I've read that Taylor Swift's current tour brings in billions of economic boost to every country that she stops in. I just checked and she's having a total of 24 shows in the UK later this year. It will definitely bring a lot of economic benefits. I want to ask if those benefits will land before the potentially still conservative autumn statement so that Jeremy Hunt can talk about the economy being optimistic, or will those benefits land for Labour and Rachel Reeves to talk about when Labour comes into government and say the economy has instantly improved?
Not, I mean, are you a Swiftie?
I am a Swiftie, and I have to say, much to my kind of disappointment, because for years I've been putting up with, enjoying Taylor Swift in the car, because our kids are all Taylor Swift fans, and I can sing 15. I don't know the rest of the words, but I'm good at saying 15. They got tickets.
Marry me, Juliet, you'll never have to be alone.
Exactly.
That's so, my attempt to I know.
Luckily, your young family is too young to be truly embarrassed by that. And probably your older kids are inured. But the terrible thing is they bought tickets for the Taylor Swift tour.
Oh, they're taking Dad. That's so nice.
I didn't make the cut.
What?
I'm not in.
What?
They bought tickets for them and a friend. I said, where's my ticket? And they said, sorry, it's Taylor Swift, the gold dust. I said, I'm your father. And they said, suck it up.
Sound like the friend ticket is dispensable.
I couldn't believe. Are you going?
Well, I'm hoping to try and get a ticket, but I'm going to try the inside route.
What is the inside route?
Having failed on the
outside route. What's the inside route?
Go maybe to Taylor herself.
Where are you going to get your ticket from?
Otherwise, I'm not going to get the ticket. If I reveal my sources, they will evaporate.
You can't go to a town.
No, I mean, apparently Keir Starmer's going to make that illegal anyway, so there'll be no ticket touts under a Labour government.
I can't believe you copped out of answering that question. I think we have to answer Jimmy's question, though. I would say, Jimmy, there would be an economic boost. Almost all the benefits of that economic boost are not going to go to the government or the taxpayer, but they're going to go to Taylor Swift. I mean, I think she's probably the one who's going to make the money out of her tour. But the interesting thing about the way the HMRC forecasts these things is that you might say she's going to come and there's going to be hotels and restaurants and travel, and that's all going to boost the amount of VAT paid. And the HMRC or the Office of National Statistics will say, I know, but that money would have been spent on something else instead. And there's no evidence to say it's going to lead to any extra spending. And therefore, there'll be no extra tax revenue. And therefore, there's no benefit at all to the Exchequer. And they may be right, but that's how they tend to think about it. So you think to yourself, as you're the Chancellor, we're going to get this big boost from Taylor Swift. And then it's just not there in the figures.
I mean, I definitely remember as Chancellor being asked and having to agree to waive tax on players in certain international competitions. If you wanted to bid for things like the Champions League final, you know, UEFA will only give you that as a country if you agree that you're not going to charge tax on the players playing in that final. Because we do charge tax, for example, on people who come and play at Wimbledon. But I remember being specifically asked, there was a tennis tournament beforehand at Eastbourne, which was seen as a sort of build-up to Wimbledon, and the Stella Artois, as it was called, at Queen's. I was asked, could we waive the tax on those tournaments for the tennis players? Because otherwise they'll go and play in places like Italy. And I didn't actually in that case. But you do come under pressure. I remember coming under pressure from the kind of British tennis establishment because I thought, frankly, you know, they can afford the tax. And if they want to come play here, they should.
But the annoying asymmetry of the fiscal forecasters is if you were to waive that tax, they would say, that's a loss of tax, and we're going to score that in the numbers. I don't know what it is about fiscal forecasters. They never want to give you the upside. But they're always happy to charge the downside.
It's sounding like Jacob Rees-Mogg and his critique of the OBR. Anyway.
By the way, you know, I think, seriously, David Davis, who I actually always had some respect for, has echoed those things. We shouldn't do it now. Let's come back and talk about what is it about these Conservative MPs, which suddenly means they want to attack the OBR and the Bank of England. I think it's a really good subject to talk about. Let's do it another time, though. We've got to get through these questions. As always, George has got another one of his jobs to get to.
Well, before I run off, we're going to be answering some more questions after this break.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So welcome back. We've got a question from Rupert.
Hi, George and Ed. My question comes from your EMQs on the 11th of March, where Ed said that politicians of every party should have listened more to the people, using the example of the pre-Brexit failure to take immigration seriously as an issue. Yet as far as I can see, immigration was pretty low on most voters' priorities in all the polls before Farage and the right-wing media focused attention and lies on it. That isn't to say that more attention shouldn't have been paid to many people's feelings that, in Lee Anderson's words, their country was being taken away from them. But isn't there a danger that a focus on listening to the people will just give power to politicians and press to amplify populist issues that previously wouldn't have had traction?
I think Rupert's question goes to the heart of what we think successful political leadership is about, and people's opinions of that will differ. But I've always thought, you know, a political leader does need to be able to say unpopular things to people, you know, has to kind of lead opinion, has to anticipate where the public might be persuaded to get to. And on a whole sort of set of social issues like gay rights or the abolition of hanging in Britain, political leaders were able to do that, even though opinion polls at the time did not want to legalize homosexuality and did not want to abolish hanging. But politicians did that. Equally, you could say Margaret Thatcher's policies were unpopular in the kind of narrow sense that people thought it was very unfair on mining communities what she was doing. But then when it came to general elections, they voted for her because they knew it was kind of necessary for the country and its progress. So my definition of political leadership is a bit more, yes, you take into account what people say, but the job of the political leader is not to follow, but to lead. That said, you know, I think in the conversations I had with you, Ed, I, over many years, not just on this podcast, on immigration, where, as I've said before, my instincts are very liberal, I think you're right that just sort of assuming people would suck up high levels of immigration and that you didn't have to explain or engage with communities on it probably turned out to be, certainly for Remainers, a fatal mistake.
If you take 2016 and you look at the polling at that point in the referendum, immigration was right up there, number one issue. If you go back to 2005, when Michael Howard tried to make immigration a big deal in the 2005 election, he didn't succeed because it was actually low down the list of issues which voters were concerned about. So the question you have to ask is, what changed between 2005 and 2016? On the basis of Rupert's argument, it changed because people like Nigel Farage whipped it up as an issue. The alternative argument is that we went from being very low levels of immigration until after 2004. By the end of the decade, very high levels in, by historical standards, of immigration into the UK, which then became a much wider issue across Europe in the early 2010s. And that people saw this happening and they worried about it and they talked about it and they were concerned about it and they didn't feel that government was addressing it. Where I agree with George is that the leadership thing to do is not to pander. You don't listen to people and then just tell them what they want to hear, because leadership is about persuasion. But if people don't think you're listening to their worries and concerns, in my view, they then don't hear anything you say. So you have to start with people's worries and concerns and understand them, and then show that there's a way to manage, control, reassure. And I think on immigration, we failed to do that effectively enough. And that allowed the sort of, you know, Farage anti-rhetoric to succeed. So I don't think the choice is to lead or to listen. I think good leaders have to do quite a lot of listening in order to start a conversation with people which chimes with what they're worried about, even if you're going to persuade them to go a different road to the populist.
I thought the 2005 election is a good example, because Michael Howard's campaign, which I was very much involved in, I was the shadow chief secretary at the time, we did report back to people what they were saying to us. People might remember those posters, "Are you thinking what we're thinking?" But in the end, they didn't trust us. And Tony Blair completely took the wind out of our sails when he gave a speech in Dover about immigration. At the time, it was about asylum seekers, quite similar to the issue now, actually. And at least for a time, you know, because he engaged seriously in the argument and we were just reporting back to people what they were saying to us, I thought he stole a lead on us. So, you know, it is interesting. I certainly learned from that. But I think that kind of generally, we probably made a mistake of not talking about immigration at all. Anyway, we obviously, big topic. We're going to come back to this again and again. We've got a question here from Catherine, which I'm just going to take on trust. You didn't put her up to, Ed.
Me?
Well, you'll hear why.
Dear Ed and George, I am a long-term Labour supporter. Sorry, George, or is it Gideon or Geoffrey? In fact, I voted for Ed in the 2010 Labour leadership election. How history could have been different if only the best Ed had won. My question to you both is, how should I vote in the next election? The reason I ask is because I live in Bath. Under the first-past-the-post system, a vote for Labour is a wasted vote. My story is replicated up and down the country. There has been lots of discussion recently about democracy in crisis. Don't we need a democratic system that works hard for its citizens too? Is it not time that both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party took electoral reform seriously?
That was a really, really good... Do you know, I wonder if we should just play it again, because it was such a good question. I wonder whether it would benefit from repetition.
How history could have been different if only the best Ed had
won. Who's in control of this podcast?
No, that was a joke.
We actually cut out. We do edit these questions just for length. And there's a bit she says here, because I've got the text in front of me. It says, "I moved to Bath 13 years ago and I've been voting for Lib Dems since." Well, thanks very much, because that was a vote for the coalition, which I was the Chancellor in. So you've got to be careful about voting Lib Dem. You're not sure what you're going to get.
Not in 2015.
No, but 13 years ago she moved there.
That is true. So I got into real trouble, Catherine, in fact, in 2010. So just a few months before you wisely, but ultimately ineffectively, voted for me in the Labour leadership election, which was, you know...
This is the parallel universe. There are philosophers who believe there are, you know, an infinite number of parallel universes where, and in one of them, Ed Balls is the British Prime Minister.
You know, I am the Gwyneth Paltrow of this podcast, and this is my sliding doors moment. But anyway, no, we're being diverted. My mum and dad lived up on the North Norfolk coast. And even though they were Labour supporters, it was a Conservative Liberal Democrat marginal. The Liberal Democrat candidate was Norman Baker. And lots of Labour supporters, Labour voters, voted for the Lib Dems. And I made
it
a...
It was Norman Lamb.
What did I say?
Norman Baker.
Norman Baker?
We We've discussed this on the Coalition podcast we did. This is the Labour problem. You don't pay any attention to Liberal Democrats.
Norman Lamb is a Norwich City supporter. I know him very well. We go to the football together. How did Baker? It just popped into my head. I don't know what happened. Anyway, in the election campaign of 2010, I say something about understanding that people make decisions to vote for the outcome they want in their constituency, and got really criticised for it. And of course, the reason is, I think actually, if you are Labour or Conservative, to advocate tactical voting is against the rules. I think it's actually a disciplinary
matter. You can get kicked out of your party.
Exactly. And it's partly that you've got a local campaigning organisation, they're working hard, they don't want to be demoralised or to be discouraged. And so you aren't allowed to say it. And so we probably, I'm thinking we should stop.
Trying to avoid being kicked out of the Labour Party.
I'm thinking we should just stop this answer now.
You would join some other prominent former Labour politicians with podcasts who aren't members of the Labour Party at the moment.
Anyway, Catherine, I think you have to do what's right.
Which is?
And I think you have to sort of, reflect upon it in yourself.
And having done that, what should she do?
Well, I mean, I think she should, vote for the outcome she wants.
Right. That's Ed trying to stay in the Labour Party, but saying vote Lib Dem.
I was a Labour politician until 2015, and those days are behind me now. Hmm. And so I'm absolutely not worried about anything like that. I'm just sort of, I'm being respectful to people in Bath. Catherine, do the right thing.
There's a good question, which is, I mean, the Conservatives are very worried about tactical voting because, you've had it before in British politics. You had it in 1997 when there was an explicit pact we subsequently discovered between Tony Blair and Paddy Ashdown, where they agreed to sort of not campaign in some of each other's seats. And they sent each other, faxed each other back in those days, the seats they didn't want the other side to campaign in, to kind of deliver the maximum impact on the Tories. This time in the age of social media, it's going to be really easy for people to work out locally how they should vote if they want to, for example, get rid of the Conservatives. And, if you do pull off a proper tactical voting operation when there's a government that people want to get rid of, it can be very effective. By the way, it was very effective in 2015 in a different way, which was persuading people not to vote Liberal Democrat because they might get a Labour government. And that was the Tory campaign we ran, although we've discussed before whether ultimately that was self-defeating for the Cameron Osborne team at the top.
Have you ever voted for a non-Conservative candidate for tactical reasons?
No.
Never?
I haven't, no.
I was at Oxford in the general election of 1987 in Oxford West and Abingdon, where the SDP candidate with Chris Huhne, and I think the Conservative was it John Paton?
Yeah, it would have been, yeah.
And in that Oxford West seat, it was impossible for Labour to win. I think Labour could win Oxford East, but not Oxford West.
But Huhne didn't win there, did he? He ended up being the MP in Eastleigh.
That's right.
Till he got into trouble with his driving offences.
I was teeing you up there to ask me a question.
Which was what?
Well... Oh, come on.
I've lost the thing.
I was saying to you, have you ever voted tactically? And then I was saying that I was living in Oxford West when the choice was SDP Conservative.
Right. So how did you vote?
No comment. So let's go to our final question.
We might be wasting people's time. Not, of course, we're not wasting.
Final question from Paul.
Hello. My question is, do you think tradition and ceremony is a good thing within British politics? Or do you think it's a barrier for progression?
I think it's a good thing. I mean, obviously, you can have too much of a good thing. But when I became Chancellor, for example, I reinstated a wonderful thing that had been going for almost 1,000 years called the Trial of the Picts, PYX. And that's when the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who's also Master of the Royal Mint, tests the coinage, or rather is put on trial while the Goldsmiths Company in the City of London tests the quality of the coinage. Because in the old days, if you had gold and silver coins, a simple way for a king to try and save some money would be to water down the gold, debase, the technical phrase, the coinage. It's very inflationary. So the Trial of the Picts existed. Gordon Brown had refused to do it because he involves wearing these big robes and it's a big kind of ceremony. Alistair Darling had decided because of the financial crash, he couldn't really pick it up. But the permanent secretary said, do you want to do the Trial of the Picts? And I said, absolutely. But there was one problem, Ed, which I want to ask you about, because when it came to it, he says, oh, great, okay, you're going to do it. You must wear the robes. And there are these amazing black robes with gold kind of inlay, which Chancellors of the Exchequer have worn for hundreds of years. So Lloyd George wore this, and Winston Churchill wore this, and Disraeli wore it, and Gladstone wore it. Anyway, came to it, and the robes had disappeared. The robes that Ken Clark had worn as Chancellor as well disappeared under the Brown Chancellorship, and no one ever found them again, and they just went missing. We had to, in the end, buy another pair of robes.
Well, Gordon used to go off to Scotland to his constituency on a Friday and carry a very large sports bag. And it was a bit of a TARDIS. If anything went into that, never came out again. So maybe he took the robes home to try them on.
Is he wandering around North Queens Ferry in the robes
speak? To answer the question, though, I think tradition can be a very binding thing. You know, a Remembrance Day and the tradition around that is so important in our society, I think. So I think tradition can play a very important role in politics. On the other hand, if you remember, George, those times when you had international statesmen come to speak in Westminster Hall, Barack Obama or Nelson Mandela, and we would all file in as members of parliament to our seats, which would be about 10 rows back. And the reason was because the front rows were all of these people from the royal household, you know, the keeper of the Queen's garter, and the holder of the sovereign's wardrobe or something. And actually, it was kind of odd, really, all this tradition, which didn't really seem to have any obvious function, but was right up there in the hierarchy. On the other hand, I guess they didn't have any power. But Penny Mordaunt.
Yes.
I mean, carrying the sword in the robes done her no harm at all. I mean, maybe that's a case of tradition and pomp and circumstance having a direct political impact on British politics this year.
Well, she may well wield that sword in the coming weeks. We will see. Anyway, thank you for all your great questions again this week. We much appreciate them.
And don't forget, you can always send us questions to questions@politicalcurrency.co.uk or on our socials, where you can find us at Polcurrency. And do post reviews on Apple or Spotify or whichever your podcast platform is. And
as long as they're five-star reviews.
As long as they're five-star reviews.
Well, as our dog walkers listening to this will go, woof, woof.
So we'll see you on Thursday for our normal pre-Easter Political Currency. See you soon.
Thanks for listening to Political Currency. This has been a Persephonica production.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.